The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you back to the session starting this afternoon. My name is Professor Kenneth Anderson. I'm one of the business law professors here at the law school, and I will be moderating today's session, this afternoon's session. And first of all, I'd like to thank all of you for being here, particularly the day after spring break. And even more like to welcome our panel here who have come from different places in the city and even down from New York to be with us today. The topic that we have overall is private equity, but we're actually going to treat this a little bit more generally. Let me just walk through our panelists. We first of all have Luke Reynolds with us, and I'm not going to actually go through where everybody's from, but Mr. Reynolds is from the FDIC. He will be talking about a topic which is not exactly related to the rest of these things, so related to consumer protection and these issues related to, I guess I'd say personal finance. So that topic is slightly out of the range of the private equity topics that we're otherwise dealing with today, and that's fine, but I wanted people to be aware of that so you wouldn't be sort of sorting through as we went. And we then have Stephen Culhane from Linklaters, who has come down from New York to be with us today, and we're absolutely delighted he could join us. He's a private equity lawyer from up there and one of the great global practices in this area. And then finally, we have Thomas Griffin, who is at Gibbons PC here in town. And with the second and third presentations, we will actually be focused in on the private equity area and then something that's unrelated but very important in the area of financial issues at the beginning. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to take about 10 minutes each, and then we will see whether there's any comments we want to make back and forth between the members of the panel, and then reserve a few minutes to take questions from all of you. So without further ado, we're going to start with Mr. Reynolds and work our way across.
Thank you. My name is Luke Reynolds. I'm with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I've been with the FDIC for about 12 years. I work in the area of consumer protection. So I manage our outreach and program development section, which works on financial inclusion and financial education issues. So my remarks are going to be a little bit more, a little bit outside the realm. I'm not going to be addressing our receivership activities or taking questions on our receivership activities. We've been fairly transparent and I'll encourage those who are looking for more information on those sorts of areas to access our website. Particularly, I think you might be interested in the press release that was just released late last week. Moving into our remarks, a root cause of the recent financial crisis has been that many consumers do not think enough or do enough before taking out mortgages that they cannot repay. Many others were duped by fraudsters. Many consumers took on too much debt, home equity lines, credit cards, car loans, and the like. Part of the problem has been that there are been many new financial products and services in the marketplace, which make it much more difficult for consumers to make smart decisions and makes it confusing for people to understand how products will impact them over the long term. And then as industry changes, those who gain some knowledge or gain some information 5 years from now, that knowledge may be outdated in the marketplace. Unequivocally, consumers benefit from having many choices, but when it comes to complex financial products, especially those that sound too good to be true, such as we've seen in the mortgage arena, a wrong decision can be costly with serious implications, not just for that consumer, but for the global economic environment. Fear, uncertainty, and desperation can also cause consumers to fall prey to scammers and fraudsters. More micro, many Americans are not even saving for rainy days, let alone investing for the long term. And then one out of four Americans are outside the financial mainstream. They're not dealing with FDIC-insured financial institutions or NCUA financial institutions. Or they may have a bank account, but they still routinely turn to alternative financial services, which tend to be high priced, like payday lenders or check cashers. And then there are investment scams, people who don't understand the difference between FDIC insurance and non-FDIC insured products. Being financially astute is nothing less than an essential survival tool. Financial education is particularly important in the current challenging economic times. People who complete a financial education class know that something that is good, too good to be true probably is. There's plenty of research that shows that financial education makes a difference and financial education positively changes consumer behavior. We did a survey through Gallup, a longitudinal evaluation, that found those that complete the financial education workshop more likely to comparison shop and use mainstream banks effectively. Financial education certainly isn't a cure-all. Government regulation and education are really two sides of the same coin. An educating consumer is a regulator's first line of defense, because ultimately it's the consumer who signs on the dotted line, and it's a consumer who makes financial decisions. A consumer who knows what questions to ask when something sounds iffy, when a consumer needs to turn to the regulators or when to turn to law enforcement is really a regulator's best weapon. People have reason to be interested again in personal finance and financial issues, but some questions for policymakers and questions for further study. Why can't we have a baseline for financial knowledge and skills? Financial education isn't taught in most schools, most colleges, universities. Sometimes it is, but to some degree. But what should a baseline be for personal finance knowledge? Should there be standards around personal finance? Should there be standards for what people should know? And then how can we integrate financial education into lifetime decision points? If a person starts a new job, they may be presented with retirement savings options, retirement investment options. What opportunities are there to require or strongly encourage there to be financial education at those points? We have to remember that one financial education course in college is not going to help people over their entire financial careers over the long term. So these are a few thoughts on the importance of financial education. With that, we'll turn to our panel that will talk specifically about private equity investment. Thanks.
Hi there. My name is Stephen Culhane. I am a partner in the investment management group at Linklaters, working in their New York office. And I think in the scheme of things here, I'm now going to be the voice of irresponsibility. As you were going through your presentation, I was reminded for some reason of a sign that one of my bosses, when I was a summer intern in college, had on his desk. He was a trader of mortgage-backed securities, and his sign in this little plaque said, "Nothing succeeds like excess." About 20 years later, I was surprised to see that this person was the chairman and CEO of, in fact, one of the major Wall Street financial institutions. And clearly it worked. Not only that, his institution is still standing. So it's an interesting game. It's an interesting world. As a next comment, I think that I also consider myself as somehow being outside of the financial mainstream. As a private equity lawyer, as a private funds lawyer who has spent the better part of the last 20 years representing sponsors of and investors in private equity funds, real estate private equity funds, and hedge funds, my practice and this, the area of the financial markets that I work in and that pays my mortgage is always known as alternative investments, and I think that puts us outside of the mainstream. But as I think the last couple of years have shown, being outside of the mainstream, if you're playing with enough money, can in fact have a very dramatic impact on the rest of the world. Not necessarily as much of an impact as perhaps some of these folks are getting credit for, but nonetheless a significant role in the national and indeed international economy. The panel discussion today was described as a discussion of the recession's impact on investments and predictions for the future. So one of the things I wanted to do was really sort of a quick overview of the current economic cycle and what that's meant for me, for my clients, and in all likelihood for many of the people in the room. And again, I'm going to go back to an anecdote. I had a client at one point who was a very big advocate of private equity and off-market transactions and claimed that the first, quote, private equity transactions predated or coincided with the growth of human civilization. He then went on to really being that first exchange of goods out on the veldt somewhere. He then went on to say that in private equity you really couldn't lose money because you were buying real assets, unlike some of these financials instruments and securities transactions where there weren't real assets involved. It took a very, very short time for that statement to have been disproved, and disproved with some vigor at the end of the dot-com era when, in fact, people lost a great deal of money in private equity. And the current cycle for me has its origins in the downturn of the dot-com era. This was a period where in the late 90s people made a great deal of money. There was a lot of excitement about private equity. And the industry boomed. It increased dramatically in size. The amount of money raised increased dramatically. The number of market participants increased dramatically. And somehow the industry became a lot more credible than it had been previously. We moved perhaps a little bit closer to the financial mainstream. Our investors became much more frequently large institutional investors. The government plans, the CalPERS and NYSTERS, and other U.S. state pension plans, the private pension plans, and indeed many non-U.S. governments became much more active participants in private equity and other, quote, alternative investment funds. When the dot-com crash occurred, that stopped. And indeed the market went through a period of some pain, and happily that pain had largely receded by 2004. The next several years were the glory years, the recent glory years. The public markets recovered, interest rates were low, the credit environment was permissive. That both of those factors, or all three of those factors, encouraged buyout transactions. The number of deals went up dramatically. The volume of the fees associated with these deals also went up. And as the market became increasingly competitive, as people wanted to get a slice of that fee income, I think like the lending market, standards declined. And indeed in the institutional lending market, we started to see things like covenant light debt structures where companies and LBO houses were able to borrow money on much more permissive terms than they had been previously. These trends were compounded by an increasing series of advantages accruing to the large buyout funds, the funds that could go out and buy very large companies, the large buyout funds. There are thousands and thousands of private equity funds in the market, but there are probably fewer than 30 private equity funds that have over $10 billion in assets. And those few very large funds were playing in a more rarefied space. They had fewer competitors. but they, so that they could bid on transactions in less competitive auctions, gave them an advantage on in terms of generating returns. It also meant, because they were buying bigger companies, that people wanted to be doing business with them because the fees were bigger. So this was a space that I think also benefited fairly dramatically from the permissive business environment in which we were operating. Things really sort of peaked in the 2007, early 2008 period for private equity. In 2007, we started seeing, maybe even late 2006, we started seeing private equity shops going public. KKR took a fund of funds public in Europe, and then we saw in fairly rapid succession Fortress, Oxif, and then finally Blackstone coming out with their IPOs. And for me, I think Blackstone was probably the very top of the market. When Steve Schwarzman sells out, somebody's getting a good value. Just probably wasn't the public investors. And there was a very funny letter that made the circuit on the internet associated with that IPO. And it anticipated a series of future events. And I dusted a copy of it off 6 or 9 months ago. And in fact, things happened much more rapidly than that letter anticipated. Now, having said that, these are fundamentally strong businesses. These are all organizations that have survived, will survive, and are characterized by a certain commercial opportunism that has allowed them to make money even as markets have gotten very difficult. And I have every confidence that they will continue to make money, and that will be sort of the last few minutes of my spiel in terms of where things go next. But at the top of the market, we saw people cashing out. We saw signs that the leaders of the industry perhaps felt that values were inflated. We started seeing very large transactions that were being done based upon very optimistic projections. We saw transactions structured upon financing arrangements that in turn had been syndicated or had been structured as part of tranched CDO products that we're getting. If you believe the newspapers and some of the recent books, inflated credit ratings, so that people were getting AAA ratings for not only mortgage-related financing, but also perhaps what in another era would have been called junk loans that had been pooled and tranched in order to give investors the sense of greater security in terms of their repayment. This continued into 2007, and enough deals were announced in 2007 that these transactions continued to carry the industry into 2008, even though it was clear at that point that the market, in fact, had changed and it was becoming progressively more difficult to close a lot of these deals. What happened when the music stopped? There were, again, a statement that as long as the music's going, you've got to keep dancing. But in fact, the music did stop. The end of easy credit meant a significant decline in transaction volume, a decline in the value of portfolio companies, a very serious, ultimately, decline in fixed income values and, indeed, the public markets. Companies were overextended. There was the prospect that a large number of companies would not be able to repay their debt. The financial institutions that had arranged these loans often found that they had more of them on their balance sheets than they had anticipated, and that perhaps the risk associated with those loans and other positions was greater, perhaps significantly greater than they had initially anticipated. Within the private equity space, this meant people started focusing on successor funds, follow-on funds, preserving the value in their portfolios, trying to extend and preserve their enterprise value, and a great deal of work on trying to make sure that portfolio companies could weather the storm. In fact, I would argue that the private equity industry probably did and has weathered the storm better than many other segments of the marketplace. But the story is not over yet. I think we've seen a number of articles recently, and indeed my firm and many other participants in the marketplace are tracking borrowings that mature over the next few years, and we're looking at that as both future capital markets transactions, but also as situations that may give rise to restructurings if it turns out that those borrowers are in fact unable to borrow on terms that are financially viable for them. So I think we will continue to see distress within the private equity markets and industry. That distress may be more pronounced perhaps in the commercial real estate space, but it really is going to be a function of where the economy goes from here. There's a lot to watch, and as a fund lawyer who used to go to partner meetings and have a not very busy bankruptcy lawyer say his day would come, the tables have changed. He's one of the busiest, indeed his entire practice and group is one of the busiest areas in our firm, and it's a very good thing that he is. What other consequences of the downturn have occurred? Huge pressures on liquidity. There are investors who built portfolios with an expectation that they were long-term investors, that they would not need access to their capital at any given time or even over extended periods of time. And those assumptions have proven to some degree inaccurate. I think that Harvard, Yale, CalPERS, and a number of other very well-known, very large institutional investors have discovered that while there may be benefits to trying to acquire a liquidity premium by going into illiquid assets, that there are limits to just how much of their assets or how much of their portfolio they indeed want to put in illiquid assets. This has been exacerbated by the slowdown in deal volume. Exits have either slowed or stopped. You can't do leverage recaps. It's harder to extract value. Investors have stopped putting money into funds because they've stopped getting money out of funds. And although there has been a burgeoning secondary market or an ability to buy interests in existing funds or indeed portfolio companies, the secondary market itself was surprisingly inactive last year. And that despite many, many predictions the year before that it would be an absolute banner year. Why was it slower? It was slower because people weren't certain about transaction, about company values. They were highly uncertain. There was a great deal of uncertainty about the ability of portfolio companies to continue to meet their debt obligations, to cover their payments, and therefore a great deal of uncertainty is, again, to the value of those portfolio investments. And it's just a general risk aversion. I think we're seeing signs now that the secondary market will pick up, that indeed it probably already has, and that we'll see a bit more reshuffling of assets as people's risk portfolios come more in line with what they really should be sort of assuming in their portfolios. And I think that we're seeing at this stage maybe the beginnings of the cyclical sale by banks of their large private equity portfolios. Hasn't happened so much yet in the United States, but we're certainly seeing that in Europe, and it's a trend that we would expect to see happening elsewhere. And if the Volcker Rule and some of the initiatives to reduce principal investing by financial institutions come through, we will see a further reshaping of the industry. So that's sort of the good news, as it were. The better news is that these secondary transactions are in fact a sign of health, that people are coming back into the market, that funds are raising money again, and indeed that deals are happening again. Many of the deals that we've been reading about recently have been strategic deals, stock deals, but we are also seeing an increase in deals within the financial players or private equity funds space. And that increase in deals and the increase in money coming into the sector, I think, augurs well for the future of the industry. Now, those benefits, I think, will be offset to some extent by a pending wave of regulatory changes. We will see changes in the United States. The Advisors Act is almost certainly going to be extended to cover a wider range of private investment advisors. People who have been exempt from registration under the Advisors Act are likely to become subject to Advisors Act regulation and SEC scrutiny. The financial institutions, the banks in particular, are going to be recalibrated in terms of the level of their participation. In Europe, we're seeing an alternative investment fund manager directive that is very heavily and hotly debated at the moment, but if it's adopted in either its current form or something resembling its current form, may have significant consequences for the alternative investment fund industry as a whole in Europe. One consequence of that, which I think Geithner stepped in on earlier within the past week, really, is the extent to which the European directive may serve as a protectionist measure for European capital markets. I think there's some debate over that, but it is likely to have a significant impact upon the alternative funds industry and the degree of integration between U.S. or sort of Western Hemisphere capital markets, European capital markets, and capital markets elsewhere in the world. We are seeing, in addition to the regulatory changes, new participants in the marketplace. Many of the larger fund managers are raising a great deal of money from the sovereign wealth funds. Indeed, at the moment, probably the single largest source of capital for the funds that we're raising is sovereign wealth funds and some of the larger U.S. state government plans. The private investors, the foundations and endowments, the pension plans have dialed back a bit, and they're still digesting some of the changes in their portfolios that have occurred over the last couple of years. But the market is clearly going to survive and will, I have every confidence, pick up again as we see a bit more transparency and predictability in terms of the regulatory environment. We're also seeing, as part of this evolution, we're seeing more emphasis on distressed investing, efforts to capitalize on the pain, to identify areas where companies or sectors or even divisions of companies are perhaps undervalued because of perceptions of the stress that they're going through. We've seen very dramatic changes in the fixed income markets over the past year as discounts have narrowed dramatically, so that there are signs of health. Other changes from a regulatory perspective, I think I should not go without mentioning this, is the prospect that carried interest will be subject to a higher level of tax. I think at some level that's been priced in within the industry, but it's a sign of the negative attention that some participants within the industry have gathered over the recent years. But the industry's here, it's still a huge industry, and it will continue to shape our and I think the global economy and marketplace. So Ken, I think that's sort of my spiel.
Let's go to Thomas, and we'll come back to take questions.
Okay.
I'll be sure.
Over you. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Tom Griffin. I'm a partner at Gibbons in New York City. I want to first thank all the members of the Business Law Brief, particularly Jessica, who I worked with on this project and who wrote most of my paper. And then Ken Anderson, thank you very much. By the way, my topic, similar to Stephen's, who, thanks Stephen, you did a great job on that. When I was thinking about the topic of the effects of the recession, which I guess some people call the Great Recession, but it almost feels like the greatest recession. I'm sure a lot of you here can remember that last year at this time, the Dow was about in the low 6,000 range. So it's, you know, it's recovered almost 60-65% since that time. So when I was thinking about writing this article, I thought about really the data and how, you know, the recession affected the raising of funds by private equity funds and also the number of deals, both strategic and non-strategic deals. And so in my article, there's a lot of graphs which I think are very helpful to understand. For instance, on a quick read basis, you can flip through my article in very quickly, and you can see that it's just a massive slope downward starting in 2008, and really last year, 2009, was one of the worst years for private equity and LBOs. So Jessica has said that she'll make that available to all the students. I should start off saying that the real crisis in the financial markets started, probably in 2007 when the mortgage securities market fell apart and those two Bear Stearns funds fell apart. The guys were indicted. The assets were fire sold to Merrill Lynch. Then you started having one thing after another. You had the Bear Stearns collapse, the quick sale to J.P. Morgan Chase. Then in September of 2008, the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers with Barclay almost resuscitating everything, but they cherry-picked and Lehman had to file for bankruptcy. Then, of course, AIG and all the other commercial banks that got bailed out and were on the brink of collapse and all that stuff with Bernanke and work and with Paulson and everything. So there was, in 2008, 2009, there was this real crisis, and all you have to do is look at the financial markets and look at the credit markets, and all the markets just went into chaos. So that obviously had a very big effect on private equity, also on the M&A business. As I said earlier, 2009 was the worst year. For example, I think my recollection is that M&A deals were down 61% in 2009, and private equity had its worst year in terms of fundraising. Actually, its worst quarter was the fourth quarter of 2009. It was the worst quarter since, I think, 2004. So the easy answer is, what effect did this panel is looking at, what effect did it have? It had a huge effect. But I think, one thing people always forget, and when Bijan was, forget his last name, from the Export-Import Bank, when he was asking the law students here, who thinks when's going to happen? Who thinks, this is going to happen, that's going to happen? For instance, this is the worst. I was talking to some people on the business law brief about this. This recession is the worst I've ever seen in my life in the job market. I'm sure everybody would say the same thing. I mean, I've been practicing law in New York City since I graduated from law school in 84. I've never seen anything like this. We had a very bad recession in 90, but nothing like this. So, it's had a profound effect on private equity, M&A, and just as profound effect on law. And I can sit here and say these are the effects and everything, but you feel the effects much more than the markets and everything. So coming back to the main point here is that so we lasted a year and a half, and then things started to get better. the thing you have to remember with these things is that they're cycles. So when somebody, when you read day in, day out in the Wall Street Journal about, you know, like last year, for instance, you know, that this might be the Great Depression, this might be that, this might be that. Well, even if it is, it goes in cycles, and it's a question of, well, when, you know, when can we see private equity? When can we see M&A activity get better? You know, when is this incredible effect going to start improving? I'd say that with M&A activity, not with private equity fundraising like Stephen was talking about, but I think it started to trickle up in the last quarter of 2009. And then I think in the this year, in the first quarter, as the stock market started to improve, I think people got a little, and deals started, the M&A deals started coming through, and people started saying, well, you know, maybe people are finally getting their toe wet, and maybe they're getting great values, and these funds, if they're buying these companies now, might get a great price. So the activity in private equity started pick up. If you look at the surveys that Preqin did, which is a big research organization that does this kind of stuff, they found that investors were cautious, but they were much more interested in putting, you know, like a CalPERS or the big institution, the big pension funds and stuff. But they wanted to be a lot more careful in terms of how they invested. So some of the fees, terms, lockups, all the other parameters of a fund that as lawyers you work on started to change, because funds would say, yeah, well, you want to put money in, sure, let's sit down and talk. Maybe we can change this, maybe we can change that. So there was some activity in the market has started to pick up. I think the M&A market, is getting to really start getting strong. For instance, in the last, the last 10 days, AIG has announced two deals. I think one's $35 billion, another's $65 billion. You all probably all read that Hilfiger is going to do a deal for, I think it's $3 billion. So the M&A market, I think, is starting to pick up. It's still the in the area I'm practicing in M&A, which is smaller middle market M&A. It's still slower. There's still nervousness and cautiousness. I heard discussion on the prior speaker saying, might there be a double dip? You know, I think there still might be a bit of sentiment in this whole market. But there is the estimates that there is, because so many of the private equity funds have held back in the last year and a half from doing deals, there's estimates that there's, $500 billion plus in quote-unquote, dry powder capital, deployable capital that they could use to get back in the market. But I think that, Stephen gave a very good analysis of what he sees taking place in the market. And I think that there's things are getting better. I think it's cautious optimism. I don't think, people are going to run and get fanatical about doing deals like it was done in a year like 2007. But I think, as Stephen was saying, certain people are concerned about regulation. Nobody knows what regulation is going to pass. So there's that adds a cautious step to these transactions. But I think it's in a lot better shape. I mean, for instance, I was I was sitting in last year, either on this day or it was today, or I can't remember whether it was the 15th or 14th. But I was in working on a transaction down in outside of Miami, and it was in the trucking business, a very large company. And there were a bunch of very savvy executives. They're very who invested a lot. And I think Bank America stock at that time was at about a dollar or something, right around $2, somewhere around there. Now it's, I think, 16 or something like that. But it shows you how much we've turned. And I mean, a lot of people thought like something like Bank America was going to go under, but need more assistance. But I think we're coming along. It's slow, it's cautious, which is good, and you know, that's the perspective you should take when you're in your classes analyzing these kind of stuff, even though you're analyzing it from a legal perspective. So I'd like to thank you, Ken.
Excellent. Thomas, thank you. I'm actually going to exercise the moderator's privilege and put a question before we turn it over to you guys. I want to put a question actually to each of you and just ask you to briefly address it now. Luke, you may decline to answer this if this is actually outside of anything which has been approved to say, but I said earlier that I wasn't going to try to relate the consumer financial remarks to anything related to private equity. Let me break that promise here. Stephen raised in his remarks, and Thomas also alluded to, the idea of large private equity funds going public. Right? In other words, going out and selling shares to the public and then going about the same kind of business, but now armed with this massive amount of public capital. And as I look back over my time watching this industry as an outsider, I'm struck by the cyclical effects of pressure for retail investors to be allowed in. And I don't mean just retail investors. I mean small retail investors like law professors. And there is this pressure. I remember it arising during the late 1990s as the tech bubble was building and things that have been alluded to earlier in the panel and the cyclical nature of this. And so here's my question, Luke. Do you think that this is a suitable area for individual retail investors on the small side to be allowed into, or looking at it from the standpoint of the kind of not such great knowledge of individual investors and consumers in finance, is this an area which is really, for whatever reason, not suitable for individual small retail investors to be involved in? And if you want to say I pass on that question, that's okay.
Well, let me say a conditional I pass. The FDIC re-regulate consumer deposits and FDIC insured financial institutions. So the activities you're describing really fall more into the purview of the Securities and Exchange Commission, or perhaps even the CFTC. So I don't know that it would be necessarily appropriate for me to talk about it. I mean, other than just from a putting on my non-FDIC hat. I think we would see the importance of disclosure, the importance that consumers know what they're getting into. There are existing rules to segregate the sale of investment products, federally insured investment products, non-federally insured investment products from federally insured deposit products. So those rules would have to apply to this degree so that people don't get confused that even though these products may be being sold under the same roof as a FDIC insured institution, that they're non-deposit products. But other than that, I wouldn't be able to remark. I think we have some expert panelists who can offer more insight.
Let me actually put the same question to both of you. Any comments you'd have on the appropriateness of whether, I mean, in a certain way, I'm really asking the question of, is this kind of thing really suitable for...
You mean in a non-public fund?
Well, yeah, should it be allowed? Is this really a suitable activity for a public company?
Well, see, a lot of the...
Right into the mic there.
A lot of the deals are, the private equity deals are only marketed to, you know, that most of them aren't even marketed to individual credit investors. So only, you know, certain types of purchasers can invest based on the terms. I mean, for instance, you know, like I think almost of the deals that the bigger deals you see, you can't get in. And on the deals that are a little smaller, obviously you would have to be an accredited investor, and you know that's a decision that has to be made by an individual with his advisor, if he has an advisor. But in terms of if these funds weren't non-public and if they were available to be sold into the public, you bring in a lot of stuff like, you know, you have know thy customer rule with the broker, suitability, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, and you get into the issues you get in with any security that's not, you know, kind of a generic stock security. When the purchaser isn't that, you know, bright, why is the, you know, and they really, the private equity funds has a lot of risk, why is the broker putting that individual into that investment?
I think I'd like to take a crack at that one too, and I think that there are two components of that. The first is the private funds industry is subject to, at least within the United States, very significant restrictions on who can participate. And as indicated, the ability to participate in a private equity fund is as a baseline restricted to persons who are accredited investors. For the majority, certainly, of the capital raised, if not the funds raising capital, you need to be a qualified purchaser, which means you need to have a reasonably large portfolio. I think, Ken, your question was more specifically geared to how do we feel about these entities going public, mm-hmm. registering under the 33 and 34 Act and being available for retail investors, for people who are not accredited investors. And there, I guess I have two comments. The first is that what we're selling, what the entities that are going public are actually operating entities rather than funds. A great deal of effort went into the alternative fund managers who have gone public to qualify for an exemption or an exception from the 40 Act determinations in order to become publicly listed. And what that means is that if you're an investor in one of these alternative investment managers who's public, you're buying an LP interest in an operating company. That operating company probably has interests, and indeed much of the value of that operating company may be embedded in the interests that they have in the GP, or rather GPs of the funds that they manage, GP interests being not securities, and therefore falling out of the Company Act analysis. But as operating companies, are these alternative investment managers intrinsically riskier than other operating companies? Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm biased given my day job, but I'm not sure that they are necessarily intrinsically riskier. And clearly the SEC's approach is one of disclose. And if you read the offering documents for any of these alternative investment managers that have gone public, they are intended to be somewhat scary documents, and somewhat maybe understating it. As publicly traded partnerships that, again, are exempt from taxation as corporations, there are interesting tax issues associated with these vehicles.
I would advise investing with caution in these enterprises. And as with any enterprise, making sure that if you do invest, that it is a portion of a more broadly constructed investment portfolio so that you don't have excessive concentrations of risk in any particular type of asset. But within a diversified portfolio, I don't know that these are inappropriate. I think that it has been interesting to see the extent to which at different points in the market cycle they have commanded premiums and sometimes very, very significant premiums relative to more traditional asset managers or indeed other financial institutions, because I think a large hedge fund shop or a large private equity shop is at core not necessarily that different from some of the traditional investment banks or other securities houses. So that's
okay,
my slightly different spin.
Let me ask, how are we doing on, do we have a few minutes? Okay, I'm going to see if I can sneak my other questions in this process, but let me open it at this point to any questions from students, and I guess you can come to the microphones if you want. Or we'll take them around. And maybe if you could just, actually, if you could stand up would be
sure.
Even better. Thank you.
About 2 hours ago, Senator Dodd introduced his legislation on financial services reform. And in it, he places the new Consumer Protection Agency within the Fed as opposed to being separate. I'd just like your opinion.
Could we ask for any comments if there are?
I'm not very familiar with that. Okay.
I have a feeling you're probably not going to comment at all.
I have an opinion, but we don't comment on pending legislation.
Okay.
Other than I would like to note that our chairman has spoken out about the need for an agency along these lines, but to leverage upon the expertise of agencies that are conducting risk management exams. And her speeches are available through our website on this topic.
Okay. Stephen, would you like to take a shot at this?
I have to say it's not a bill at this point that I'm familiar with. So are there benefits to a consumer protection agency in the financial sphere? I think clearly there are. Is it something that will invariably prevent us from experiencing, you know, bad events in the future? I suspect it is not. Like it or not, I think the economic cycle is something that we have and will continue to live with. My biggest concern is that often bad legislation is worse than no legislation. Where does that leave me here? To be honest, at this stage, I really don't know. I haven't had a chance to look at it. I think a lot of good can be done. I just don't know enough about this bill to take a view on it. So
right, we're going to
apologies for punting.
2 hours is probably too quick, even for our panel. Go ahead, Jeremiah.
Hi, thank you all for coming. We had a panel here a couple weeks ago. It was a meeting of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And we had a professor from the University of Chicago saying, the commission asked him, do we need to bail out these banks? And the guy said, well, we thought we did, and that meant that we did, because nobody knew how interconnected everything was. And if we did know it, how interconnected everything was, then we could make a more informed decision about whether or not we need to bail out those banks. And it struck me that left out, even if we had perfect information about those banks, it would have left out the significant role that alternative investments played in helping big banks hedge some of their investments. So I wonder if there's a way to a regime that you can imagine that we would have that sort of information about how alternative investment vehicles are helping banks hedge without adding a whole lot of drag to the alternative investment process.
And let me, for those of you who may not be familiar with this issue, let me sort of simplify it a lot, I guess, by saying that it's really, I suppose, in part asking the question of whether private equity
firms should be included as part of the package of firms that are regulated as part of systemic risk. Jeremiah, would that be a fair shrink down? Okay. Anybody want to take a shot at
that? You know, I'll take a shot at that. I think that even the largest private equity funds are probably not of the level of magnitude and involvement in the day-to-day life of your typical consumer or financial actor as some of the larger commercial banks or indeed insurance companies, so that while I think that regulation is important, I think that at least as much attention should be paid to the enforcement of regulation that's already on the books, and I think there have been failures there. I would approach additional regulation cautiously with a few exceptions. I would say that transparency is important. I would say that the ability to scrutinize market participants is important. I'm not sure how many of the private equity funds or even the hedge funds at this stage are systemically important players in the marketplace, certainly in the way that long-term capital would have been in 98. I guess I would also note that, among the many sectors of the economy that did receive bailouts, private equity and hedge funds were exceptions, and they seem to have survived. Some of that, no doubt, was through luck. Some of it was I think, through being probably astute investors. And, you know, what does that mean for the industry? I'm not sure. I do think that some things like the ability to engage in short selling has a role in terms of transmitting information within the marketplaces, and I would be loath to see too many restrictions imposed upon a sector of the economy that tends to be faster moving than some of the larger financial institutions. And I think that additional speed can be socially beneficial.
We have time for one more question? Okay.
Mr. Kohan, in your remarks, you briefly spoke about the credit rating process and sounded a bit skeptical of the proposition that perhaps there are conflicts of interest in the rating process that may have contributed to the financial crisis. And I was wondering if anybody on the panel might want to elaborate further on that.
Well, I would say that I don't – if it came across as skepticism, it shouldn't have. I think that there were conflicts of interest. I know that I worked on a product in that closed in the first quarter of 2007, and we were quite relieved when, in fact, it closed because it was a complicated and expensive transaction. The product was highly risky. It was built around a valuation model that certainly the lawyers working on the transaction did not fully understand, and we tried to make it very clear in the disclosure documents relating to this transaction that this was a very high-risk transaction. I think conflicts of interest are a source of significant risk in the marketplace. I don't think those risks are limited to private equity or hedge funds or the financial industry itself. But I think that those conflicts of interest and the impact that they may have on people's conduct are things that people need to be very, very closely attuned to. And to the extent that we can actually parse apart some of those conflicts of interest and the way in which they affect people's behavior, we're all likely to benefit from it. I think that rating agencies were in fact swayed by the revenues that that some of the transactions generated. And you know, hopefully that's an area that will change.
Tom, yeah, the only thing, I guess this was in response to the prior question. I'll be very short. I think that what's going to happen, even though it's very difficult for Congress and to pass things these days, but I think what's going to happen is you'll have regulation of complex financial instruments. And I don't think that the funds, whether it's a hedge fund or a private equity fund, I don't think they will be regulated that much. They might, you know, there might be some stuff under the Investment Advisors Act. But I think that in viewing this, and just my personal view, is that if the complex financial instruments like swaps, et cetera, and mortgage back, et cetera, if those had been regulated, I don't think we would have had the degree of the collapse that we did.
All right, I'm going to thank our panelists for addressing these questions and also the remarks they've made, and also both of you for coming down from New York today in the rain. With that, we will now adjourn. And let me just ask before we break, how much time do you want before the next